Come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. You Catholic girls start much too late. All the sooner or later it comes down to fate. I might as well will be the one. Well, they showed you a statue, told you to pray. They built you a temple and locked you away. Ah, but they never told you the price that you pay. The things that you might have done. Only the good die.
Hi everyone, this is Dr. Michael Walden. Thank you so much for joining me today on Ask the Blood Detective. This is the show where you get to be your own blood detective. And for those of you who've been listening to my shows, you know that each hour of my show is like a mini master's course in whatever topic we're talking about. And today's topic is a very, very important one, very fundamental. It has to do with prescription and over-the-counter medications and the effects of drugs upon the body and, very importantly, whether or not it's possible to either replace medications with lifestyle and nutrition or to reduce one's needed dose of medication if you decide to take one, and also whether or not natural methods can help offset side effects. You know, if you look at the physician's desk reference book, the PDR, that's the drug Bible, 3/4 of that book describes the side effects of medication. And about 1/3 of that 4 to 5 inch book is about the drug description. So medications, even in the best scenario, carry significant health risks. And I don't think anyone in medicine would deny that fact. But the question comes to mind, well, are medications overly prescribed? Well, there's no secret that opioids have been overly prescribed to the point of killing hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of individuals. And the opioids were prescribed by physicians given their best judgment. So the opioid epidemic is just one example that has become unavoidable, which explains how bad this drug problem is. Now, although my conversation today is not only about opioids, there are a few facts that I do want to mention about opioids. Now, first of all, overdose deaths involving prescription opioids have quadrupled since 1999, and so have the sales of these particular medications. And from 1999 to 2015, more than 183,000 people have died in the United States from overdoses related to prescription opioids. And strangely enough, it's opioid overprescribing that continues to fuel this epidemic. Nearly half of all the US opioid overdose deaths involve a prescription opioid. In 2015, more than 15,000 people died from overdoses involving these drugs. And opioids include methadone, for example, oxycodone, such as OxyContin, hydrocodone, such as Vicodin. What's even more shocking is that among the people that died from prescription opioid overdoses between 1999 and 2014, the overdose rates were the highest among people between the ages 25 and 54. People are dying literally in the prime of their lives. And the opioid epidemic is so bad that it simply cannot be avoided. You can hardly turn on a news show and not hear something about this problem. Now, what I'm suggesting is that we have a problem with many other medications as well. We have drug overdose and overprescribing and issues with other medications as well, but they're simply not in the news right now. So we should learn, I believe, something from this opioid epidemic. We should know that the overdose rates of opioids were highest among non-Hispanic whites and American Indian or Alaskan Natives compared to non-Hispanic blacks and Hispanics. Men were more likely to die from overdoses, but the mortality gap between women and men is closing fast. What's important is a couple of additional risks regarding opioids is that overdose is not the only risk related to prescription opioids. Their misuse, their abuse, and an opioid use disorder, which is an addiction, are also very prevalent dangers. In 2014, almost 2 million Americans abused or were dependent on prescription opioids. I certainly know people that are personally. Do you? You would be surprised. As many as 1 in 4 people who receive prescription opioids long-term for non-cancer pain get this in the primary care setting, and then they struggle with addiction. So it's our primary healthcare providers that are causing people to be hooked on opioids. They're creating addicts, literally. Every day, over 1,000 people are treated in emergency departments for misuse of prescription opioids. But I mentioned not too long ago that there are many other medications that, at least in the United States, are being overprescribed. Let me at least mention to you at least the top 10 prescribed medications. And then we're going to talk about whether or not something can be done in the natural healthcare arena to reduce the need for these medications. So atorvastatin calcium, which is the generic form of Lipitor, which is used to treat high cholesterol and supposedly to lower the risk of stroke and heart attack and other cardiovascular complications, for people with type 2 diabetes, for example, is the number one prescribed drug based on a 2016 review. Levothyroxine, which is the generic name for Synthroid. This is a medication that treats hypothyroidism or low thyroid hormone. It's also used to prevent a condition called goiter, which is an enlarged thyroid gland. And also, this drug is used for people with other related hormone imbalances, those that receive radiation or surgery or have cancer to the thyroid. That's number two on the list of drugs filled in the United States since 2016. Once again, Lipitor number one, which is the generic name is atorvastatin. Number two is levothyroxine. Let me mention one more, and then let's talk about natural ways of lowering the need for these medications and offsetting side effects of these medications. The third most commonly prescribed medication, based on the 2016 summary, is known as lisinopril, the generic for Prinivil. Now, lisinopril is used to treat high blood pressure or hypertension or congestive heart failure. And it's also used supposedly to improve survival after a heart attack. So let's look at these three drugs for a moment. Atorvastatin. Well, the one thing is this. If a person is told that they have a number of high blood fats, a high cholesterol level, a high cholesterol HDL level, maybe they have high triglycerides or a high LDL. These are some of the reasons why a physician would place a person on atorvastatin or the generic, a drug name actually, of Lipitor. Now, this medication is not without its own side effects. I'm going to focus on the nutritional aspects of things in the short time that we have today, because these are very practical. So, for example, Lipitor reduces the body's metabolism and use. It blocks the use of coenzyme Q10. So, CoQ10, for those of you who haven't heard of this, is also known as ubiquinone because CoQ10 is ubiquitous in the body. It is everywhere. It's needed for cells to make energy. In my practice, I supply my patients with ubiquinol, which is different than ubiquinone. Ubiquinol is the active form of ubiquinone. And again, we're talking about coenzyme Q10 here, a very important natural substance. And what that substance does, among other things, is it also lowers cardiovascular risk. But in a person that is taking Lipitor, the body's use of CoQ10 drops. The body's use for beta carotene drops, meaning that Lipitor interferes with your body's use of coenzyme Q10 and its absorption and metabolism. It's really its metabolism. And also that of beta carotene. CoQ10 has been studied as a cancer preventative, use in fibromyalgia, use in low metabolic rate and weight loss, many different health issues. Why? Well, again, it's very convenient. It is found in every cell. That's why it was named ubiquinol. Now, if a person is put on Lipitor, they should be put on coenzyme Q10. I hardly ever see this happen in practice. And it's even described in the Bible of drugs known as the physician's desk reference. It says right in there that CoQ10 should be provided. Also beta carotene. Now beta carotene is a very important antioxidant and immune modulating nutrient. Now, like CoQ10, beta-carotene is fat-soluble. That is the reason why Lipitor interferes with the body's metabolism of both CoQ10 and beta-carotene, because Lipitor adversely affects fat metabolism. That's what it was designed to do. Remember, LDL, cholesterol, triglycerides, total cholesterol, those are fats. So it makes sense that Lipitor would target that, but it doesn't just target that. There are other fat-soluble nutrients that are very important for cardiovascular health that could potentially be used in place of statin medication like Lipitor and have virtually no side effects. I've mentioned two, CoQ10 and beta-carotene. The average dose of CoQ10 that I usually give is 200 milligrams. If you're overweight, it's 400 milligrams. You know, I've said this on my other shows, but it's not enough for you to just take the nutrient that you need. You must take it in a dose that is based on your body weight, or better yet, your metabolic rate. And you can figure out your metabolic rate with a test known as a body composition test. It's a non-invasive test. It just takes minutes, and it can tell your healthcare provider how you burn things up. But it'll also tell you three other important factors. These three factors are important when you're taking medication and or nutrients to idealize dosing. You need to know your body's percentage of lean mass versus fat mass. Lean mass is the type of mass of your body that has to do with use of drugs and nutrients. So if you do not know that, if you do not know the percentage of your lean mass, you are taking a wild guess in terms of your dose of nutrition for sure. Now, physicians tend to base prescription dosing based on guidelines provided to them by pharmaceutical companies. Now, some argue that pharmaceutical companies want to sell their drugs, so they make unnecessarily high recommendations in terms of starting dosage guidelines for physicians. Smart physicians know that people react very differently to medications, and smart nutritional or holistic practitioners know the very same thing about nutritional supplements. Now, let's back up. We were talking about Lipitor. That interferes with fat metabolism. So in theory, it can lower blood fats. But so can CoQ10, beta carotene. Now, a few other fat-soluble nutrients that are interfered with Lipitor and can be used and have been very well studied to reduce one's risk of all-cause morbidity and mortality, by the way, not to mention death and incidence of cardiovascular disease, involves omega-3 fats. So an example of an omega-3 fat is fish oil, also possibly flax oil. Flax oil is an omega-3, 6, and 9. But the omega-3s, the omega-6s, and the omega-9s are interfered with statin medications like Lipitor. So anyone out there taking these medications should seek the advice of a qualified nutritional healthcare specialist to see if you should be on CoQ10, beta carotene, or one or another form of omega-3, 6, or 9 fatty acid. Other fat-soluble compounds, natural compounds, may also be interfered with people taking statins. Another example would be lipoic acid. Lipoic acid, or alpha-lipoic acid, as it's commonly known, is in the B vitamin family. It is both a fat-soluble nutrient and a water-soluble nutrient, which means it's used in the body in places where we're mostly water, like certain parts of our cells called the systole, and also in areas of our cells, our tissues, and our organ systems that are fatty, like cell membranes and certain organelles, which are tiny little organs of cells. We all need these nutrients. How much you need of all of these should depend not just on your total weight, but on your lean body mass and your metabolic rate. Now, pretty much every one of you out there knows that if you exercise correctly and if you eat a healthy diet, let's just define that for a moment. Personally speaking, if I were to choose one way that people should be eating today, if you force me to say what it is, it would be a vegan diet. Now, there are definitely cases where a vegan diet will not contain the proper amount of nutrition that a certain health problem would require, but it is a very important base. I do believe that all of us, many of us, I should say, can reduce the need for medications or completely get off many medications by just losing weight in a healthy way. But not only losing the weight, folks, losing the weight from fat and water. You do not want to lose an ounce of lean body mass. And the way that you can offset that is you do a bioimpedance test, which measures your lean body mass. And then with the help of a nutritional provider, they balance out, they say to you, okay, we'll start with a vegan type diet, but maybe you need more protein based on lean body mass. This is how many grams of protein you should eat each day to maintain your current lean body mass. But if you want to improve your lean body mass, improve the way your body handles drugs so you can reduce their doses, possibly eliminate them, you need to measure the lean body mass. That also gives practitioners like myself an idea of the dosing of all your nutrients and even medications. To back up, give you these practical numbers, as I said earlier, the average dose of CoQ10 in the form of ubiquinol, that's the most active form of CoQ10, is 200 milligrams, or double that if you're overweight by 5 pounds or more. The amount of beta carotene everyone should be taking is roughly 25,000 international units, or IUs. How much fish oil, how many omega-3s should you take? Well, generally about 4 grams per day. 1 gram equals 1,000 milligrams. You might say, really? I only take 250, 300, 400, 500 milligrams. These doses are generally too low. Now, I should give you a warning slash disclaimer again that if you are on blood thinning medication like aspirin or warfarin, which is Coumadin, you must be under the healthcare guidance of someone who knows what they're talking about in the area of nutrition, because certain nutrients like omega-3 fats, like CoQ10, like garlic, these can thin the blood. These nutrients on top of medications have a supra-additive effect where you can have too much blood thinning, which puts you at risk of hemorrhage or hemorrhagic stroke. I mean, it's a terrible thing. When someone has thrombotic stroke, in other words, there's a thrombus, a clot, that blocks an area of the brain and someone has a stroke, and then they try to help themselves with nutrition to thin their blood, only to increase their risk of the opposite form of a stroke, hemorrhagic stroke. It doesn't happen often, but these are potential realities of drug-nutrient interactions. There are hundreds of adverse drug-nutrient interactions, meaning lots of examples of nutrients and drugs that, when combined together, create issues. We don't have time to go over all of those, and their considerations change relative to each person at times. I will tell you, for example, just as a side note, is that grapefruits interfere with many, many, many different drugs. The grapefruit has a chemical in it that slows down the metabolism of many different medications, and that means the medications could reach toxic effects in the body. Now, we were talking about the basic healthy diet that probably is the foundation that most of us should consider, at least from our thinking, you know, and just being mindful of when we make food choices, and then build upon that with nutrients and exercise towards either avoiding medication or reducing the dose of the medication you're on and or lowering the side effects of medications. We said it was a vegan or vegetarian diet. We want to eat as low down on the food chain as possible. If you do eat meat, if you do eat chicken, and you do eat fish, you want these things organic, you want them free range, you want them as clean as possible, and you don't want to have red meat, fish, or chicken more than once per week for lots of reasons. You know, there's a term in medicine and healthcare of what you do first with certain health problems, and it's called the first line therapy. So if someone has high cholesterol, unless it's over 300 of total cholesterol in most cases, the first line therapy, the thing that's supposed to be done first with that person, is to change their eating habits and to exercise. Obviously, if someone wants to lower lipids, they need to reduce their intake of saturated fats and trans fats, also sugar and refined and processed carbohydrates and white flours. That, on top of a vegan type diet, is the best way to go to make the strongest attempt at either getting off meds, reducing side effects, or avoiding the medications in the first place. But all too often, I see physicians jumping to these medications, not teaching people how to live well to get off these medications. You know, a fair question would be, well, Dr. Wald, why would I want to get off a medication? Why should I take 10 nutrients and eat like you say I should when I could take a little pill and that can handle everything? Well, that does sound very attractive on the surface, I'll admit, but there is often a difference between how you fix a problem. So for example, if you clean up your diet and exercise and take some nutritional supplements, you could certainly lower, potentially, your total cholesterol, triglycerides, your LDL, and therefore lower your cholesterol HDL ratio. Now, if you take a medication for lowering lipids, you certainly could do that as well. So if you look at the lab tests, one person that lowers their lipids, their blood fats, with lifestyle to a certain level, which is acceptable, and then the same person who lowers it with medication, the rate of cardiovascular events is still higher in the individual who lowered their lab values with the medication. So very often, how you do a thing matters, even if it looks the same on paper. Part of the reason I suspect why natural approaches are better in most cases, or certainly in many cases, is because lifestyle is fixing metabolic issues. Medications do not really fix issues very often. There are cases where they do, but they are not actually fixing the nutritional derangements, the nutritional deficiencies or insufficiencies or imbalances. So that is the main reason why we would first want to look at lifestyle and natural remedies if you want to avoid medication use. Now, when it comes to a medication like levothyroxine or Synthroid, which is given for low thyroid, so a person may have hypothyroid, which is low thyroid, that is related to immune problems. So they'll be given a diagnosis of Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which means that there are antibodies made by that person's body, which attacks not only their thyroid gland, but sometimes also the enzymes that the body requires to take the one thyroid hormone called T4 and turn it into the active thyroid hormone called T3. Now, it matters as blood detectors. We need to know if someone's low thyroid is immune or not immune. That's the first thing you need to know. And secondly, whether or not, if it is autoimmune, if the individual has antibodies against the thyroid itself and or against those enzymes, because that changes the nutrition. For example, if some of you out there have hypothyroidism, known as Hashimoto's, and you have antibodies against an enzyme called thyroid peroxidase, then you definitely need to have more selenium in your diet, and also in the form of a nutritional supplement. The best form of selenium is called selenomethionine. Studies have shown that hypothyroidism can be improved with the addition of selenium. Now, some of you are thinking of iodine. Well, there are cases when iodine will help the thyroid, because when you're dealing with thyroid hormones, you know, the abbreviation for the thyroid hormone is T4 or T3, to just simplify it for a second. The 3 and the 4 mean that there are 3 and 4 iodines attached to the T, and the T is tyrosine. Tyrosine is an amino acid, so people with low thyroid usually need tyrosine. And if they take all this iodine, and I see a lot of iodine overdosing, they are missing the boat and also oversimplifying things. I'm not saying iodine is not important, but it is not nearly as important as people seem to be thinking. That's another topic. So, if someone wants to avoid thyroid hormones, thyroid medication, they need to improve their protein intake, because proteins contain all of the amino acids we need for immune repair, and I prefer plant proteins, a rice and pea combination, which is complete. And also, I usually provide extra tyrosine, which is one particular amino acid. And your body might have a problem making it. Now, you may not have Hashimoto's thyroiditis. You might not even have a diagnosed hypothyroidism, but you might suspect that your thyroid is too low. One symptom and sign of that would be you might have dry skin, itchy skin, thin skin, brittle nails, tooth issues, hair, nails. All of these tissues tend to start to break down with low thyroid. You might be a bit depressed. Your stress tolerance might be fairly low. You might feel sluggish. You might have difficulty keeping weight off because your metabolism is slow. Remember, your thyroid increases metabolism. So before a person jumps to thyroid medication, and a lot of people in the natural field pop Armour thyroid and Nature thyroid as if it's somehow safer than Synthroid. Well, Synthroid is synthetic, I'll give you that. But these natural forms like Armour thyroid and Nature thyroid, these are not standardized. You might be getting different doses every time you take it. So there are problems with that too. I'm not saying they should never be used, not at all. But what I am saying is protein has to be balanced against your metabolic rate, extra tyrosine. I usually provide it in my amino complex supplement, possibly iodine, and selenium at about 200 micrograms in the form of selenomethionine. Also, as some of you know, dietarily, eliminating entirely all of the cruciferous vegetables is important if you're going to make a full attempt to either get off thyroid medication or to lower your need for it or to reduce side effects. Now, goitrogen foods, as the name would imply, are types of foods that have the potential of interfering with the thyroid gland. So these are the cruciferous vegetable groups such as cabbage and Brussels sprouts and broccoli and cauliflower, mustard greens, kale, turnips, and certain isoflavones like soy. So these tend to block thyroid peroxidase, which is an enzyme needed by the body to turn T4 thyroid hormone into the much, much more active T3. Now, on the other hand, well, let me just complete that thought. So all of those would have to be eliminated. The diet would have to be cleaned up in the way we described earlier. Now, if you have other health issues, then the diet would change. But the nutritional focus would be what I had just mentioned for the thyroid. But I need to say this at this point. I'm reviewing some of the top nutrients that could potentially help a person either avoid a certain medication and or reduce its dosage or reduce side effects. But as a blood detective, as your own personal blood detective, you can imagine that when you look at your entire health in terms of health history, health goals, health problems, and the specific abnormalities on your laboratory testing, you might need nutrients that are very different from what I'm saying right now. Your doses might be more, your doses might be less. You might need a nutrient for your general health that helps you, let's say, absorb better so that when you take these nutrients, which could potentially lower your blood fats and reduce your cardiovascular risk, and when you take these nutrients and eat these foods that might improve your thyroid, that they actually work. So for example, and I'm oversimplifying, but this is often true. If you are over 50, you malabsorb. That's the end of the story. And if you malabsorb, let's say, magnesium, then you need that magnesium for all of those other supplements and foods to work as well. If you have malabsorption in your intestinal tract, you might have no symptoms of intestinal problems at all, but you might suffer from loss of bone density, which, by the way, is very common in hypothyroidism. My point is, if you have bone loss from malabsorption of calcium, you could eat all the calcium you want. You need to fix your stomach acid to activate that calcium so it knows to go in bones, so it does not deposit in your breast tissue, creating calcium-laden breast cysts. You need your stomach acid to use that calcium so the calcium does not deposit in your arteries, causing atherosclerosis, hardening of the arteries. You need it to go in your bones. So you need stomach acid if you malabsorb. But some people with malabsorption do not need stomach acid. They might malabsorb because they need enzymes, lipase, amylase, and proteases. If you don't fix your absorption first, very little of what I'm talking about in terms of nutrients and diet that can help reduce your need or risks of taking medications, they simply will not work very well. They may not work at all. There was a study that showed that for people taking Synthroid, that's for thyroid health, for hypothyroid, along with selenium, they had much better control of their thyroid gland and required less of a dose of Synthroid. So that is a very positive drug nutrient. And you know, this whole concept of absorption, which changes all the rules, brings me to the fourth most prescribed drug in the United States. And that is Prilosec, or omeprazole. So this medication is used to treat the symptoms of reflux, which is heartburn, or what's known as a gastroesophageal reflux disease. That's a fancy term for GERD, and other conditions caused by excessive stomach acid. But here's the problem. Almost always, people do not have excessive stomach acid. And you might say, Dr. Wald, what are you talking about? If a person has heartburn, then that's excessive stomach acid. Well, that means that there is excessive stomach acid that has made its way into the esophagus, but the person could have low, and often does, have low or even, well, I should say low stomach acid in the stomach. And because of that, think of this. Think of the stomach as a beaker, and it has a line of gastric liquid or hydrochloric acid. You can see it like pouring water in the beaker, okay? Think of the water as stomach acid. When the stomach lining, when the beaker's lining does not make enough stomach acid, it confuses the nervous system. And at the top of the beaker, there's a valve. It's either open or closed or somewhere in between. And people with low stomach acid, that triggers the brain to tell the valve to open up, either partially or fully. And that will cause the stomach acid, which is low in the stomach, but it's still stomach acid. Stomach acid is stomach acid, whether or not it's low in amount or high. And it makes its way into the esophagus because that valve opens up. So the reason why a person with low stomach acid can have heartburn is because the acid is in the wrong place. The esophagus gets inflamed. That's called esophagitis. And the cells of the esophagus are just not made to deal with stomach acid. But gastroenterologists and primary healthcare doctors and family practitioners, they give antacids like omeprazole. This is Prilosec, the fourth most prescribed medication in the United States because of this. Now, I understand doing that because you want to reduce a person's symptoms, but there are other ways of doing that. So, first of all, omeprazole is an antacid. It lowers the amount of stomach acid to near zero, and that is a problem. Briefly, but importantly, hypochlorhydria is low stomach acid. Achlorhydria is no stomach acid. And many of these medications, like omeprazole, reduce the stomach acid to nil. That means you cannot ionize your calcium. That means you could take all the calcium in the world. It becomes dangerous, potentially, for you. You cannot digest your proteins normally because you must have stomach acid to break down proteins into all those important amino acids, such as tyrosine that we were talking about earlier. And also, we need stomach acid to keep the stomach essentially aseptic. If the stomach acid is low, then all kinds of bacteria and things can overgrow, and that creates an intestinal nightmare known as dysbiosis, which is related to leaky gut syndrome and bacterial overgrowth. Also, we know that one's risk of getting the flu is much higher with taking antacids, the risk of bone loss, osteoporosis, for reasons I've talked about, and many other health issues are caused by lowering of stomach acid. It is astounding to me that gastroenterologists and others prescribing these medications often do not make any natural attempts to avoid these potentially dangerous medications. Now, some of you also know that an infection of the stomach called H. pylori is a very common cause of heartburn. And that infection is missed a lot. And people suffer for decades sometimes when they could have directed improvements in the diet and supplementation to killing off this H. pylori. Or at the very, very least, they could use what's known as triple therapy, which is a medication combination of antibiotics and an antacid. But again, we're talking about how do you avoid those things. If you want to avoid omeprazole, you must look at your diet. You, of course, must eliminate the fried and fatty foods, sugary foods. You have to chew your foods very, very, very well. You want to drink a little bit more water. with your meals to just wash excess stomach acid from your esophagus into your stomach. When you eat, you want to be sitting down. You want to relax. You want to be thinking about your food. All of this has a beneficial effect upon the autonomic nervous system. The autonomic nervous system helps your intestines work. Now, to throw out a couple of commonly used natural remedies for stomach acid beyond just cleaning up the diet, and by the way, not doing exercises that put undue strain on your stomach area, such as inversions where you're putting your head lower than your heart. So down dogs in yoga when you have heartburn, not a good thing. You definitely don't walk on your hands. That's definitely not good. When you go to the bathroom, you want to, number two, you want to breathe. You do not want to be holding your breath. You do not want to increase your intra-abdominal pressure. That will force stomach acids generally upward through your esophagus, worsening heartburn. So there's those and there's other lifestyle ways of mitigating heartburn or reflux. And then I like to use what's known as deglycerinated licorice, DGL. You cannot use regular licorice or even a supplement of licorice. You must use the deglycerinated form. I use it in a powder combined with glutamine and aloe that you drink. So it can coat the esophagus and also the stomach lining. It also, because it's a drink, it creates a larger surface area for absorption. And the DGL has been shown to help build up the mucus protective layer in your esophagus, and even in the stomach possibly. And that is an effect that none of the current antacid medications work on. Antacids do not fix anything. At best, they do work, quote unquote, when you're taking them. Some people, they don't. But they're not fixing the reason why you needed these medications in the first place. You can figure that out yourself. If a person would stop taking their medication, their symptoms come back. And again, I'm not telling you to do that if you're on medication. So DGL is, along with glutamine. Glutamine is the most abundant amino acid in the human body, and it helps repair the cellular lining of cells. It also improves immunity. It has many beneficial effects, even in traditional medicine. It's used in what's known as the total parenteral nutrition given to people in critical care units, for example, in other areas of the hospital as well. There's a form of zinc called zinc carnosine. That's a particular type of zinc that helps heal inflammatory changes in the stomach, like gastritis, which commonly accompanies GERD. And all you people out there who are on these medications and know you have GERD, you're also thinking, yeah, I have a hernia as well. It seems everyone's diagnosed with a hernia. I think that's used to bill insurance claims by gastroenterologists. But having said that, certainly a hernia will affect the dynamics of the gastrointestinal tract, particularly the esophagus, and worsen the situation. So that might have to be managed as well. But Zinlori at 150 milligrams has been shown to be very effective for heartburn. In addition, there are dozens of phytonutrients, chemicals in foods, in plants, that are shown to help reduce the overgrowth of H. pylori, which we said is a common cause of GERD. It's even thought to be the most common. But also, these phytonutrients reduce inflammation in the intestinal tract. They help manage immunity. And they do have a bacterial killing effect. And they act as probiotics, which means they increase your body's own production of healthy bugs. And those are in what I call, and you've heard, I didn't make up the name, obviously, superfoods. So the products that I use for any manner of general health for people, the only people I do not put on my superfood products are people that are on blood thinners. The reason, again, is with many plant foods, if you're on Coumadin, for example, which is a blood thinner in particular, and you start juicing a lot with greens or adding a superfood green powder, that is a problem, because that almost certainly will impair how Coumadin works. If you're going to take Coumadin to thin blood, then you want it to work. You want it to thin blood. You do not want to be adding any changes in your diet of foods that contain vitamin K, which many dark green leafy vegetables do. They have vitamin K, which promotes clotting, and Coumadin is an anti-clotting factor, so that doesn't make any sense. And by the way, it's not commonly known, but avocados are very high in vitamin K, and if a person is on Coumadin, they should not start eating a bunch of avocados, even though you might have heard that avocados, being a monounsaturated fat, might lower your cardiovascular risk. If you're on Coumadin, you don't take it. Okay? So again, when you see a nutritional provider, you must see someone who is knowledgeable in drug-nutrient interactions. Now, when I received my training as a dietitian, I received very, very little training in drug-nutrient interactions. When I received my certified nutrition specialist certification through New York State, I received no training in drug-nutrient interactions. When I completed my master's in human nutrition, I received no training in drug-nutrient interactions. It takes a very conscientious effort on the part of a healthcare provider to learn these things, because school does not teach us everything. In chiropractic school, I did have a course within which, on pharmacology, that we did learn about drug-nutrient interactions. But again, these reactions they're piling up more and more all the time, as you can imagine. And when I completed my medical school education, I, of course, took several courses on pharmacology and learned some basic drug-nutrient interactions. And right now, being involved in a nursing program, they do, in fact, teach a handful. When I say handful, I literally mean a handful. 5, maybe 7, possibly 10 drug-nutrient interactions. So when I see a patient, I make sure that I look up on more than one reliable search engine drug-nutrient interactions. Very, very important. Getting back to the superfoods, again, if one wants to reduce one's need for medication or help them work, with the exception of Coumadin, I advise my patients to take superfoods. I have what's called Detox 1, Detox 2, Detox 3, and Detox 4. And they have different colors. One's red, one's orange, one's green, and one is purple. And they are those colors, as you can imagine, based on the concentrations of particular plant phytonutrients that I wanted in those products. And I use these in different amounts for different people, depending on their issues. But I generally start all of my patients on them, because if a person does nothing for their diet and their lifestyle and their health at all, and they just increase their intake of phytonutrients and plant products, well, your common sense will tell you that that's got to be a good thing in almost every circumstance. So I start my patients off with a half of a scoop each of Detox 1 through 4, all mixed together, diluted in water to taste. Now, let's get back to our list of commonly prescribed medications. We started off by saying that atorvastatin or Lipitor is the number one prescribed drug. Then there's levothyroxine or Synthroid for the thyroid, number 2. Now, I jumped to number 4, which was omeprazole, which is generic for Prilosec, because we were talking about malabsorption. But I did not tell you number 3. The third most commonly prescribed medication in the United States is lisinopril, and that's used to treat high blood pressure and also congestive heart failure. It's also used to improve survival of the individual after a heart attack. But there are many changes that one can make in their diet and their lifestyle to reduce blood pressure. Again, you should never try to remove yourself off medication without the supervision of a licensed physician. Hopefully that physician has training in nutrition, because when people just stop medications, bad things can happen, including death. You don't do it. Now, what you do, or what I do with many people, and this does vary from person to person, is we build their health to a certain point that we feel comfortable that, okay, maybe it's time we speak to the prescribing doctor about tailoring or tapering off the medication. This makes sense. We know that hypertension, we know congestive heart failure are influenced by lifestyle. Exercise, for example, and diet, and even nutritional supplements. The use of magnesium in different forms. There's magnesium citrate, there's magnesium orotate, there's magnesium aspartate. There's different forms of magnesium, that, and magnesium sulfate, for example, which is very well shown to lower blood pressure when used correctly. Does it work on everyone? Of course not. But there's tons of study on the use of magnesium sulfate. So I generally have people take magnesium until they get a bit of a loose stool, and then I back off on the dose. That's their tolerance. They want as high of a magnesium as they can reasonably stand. But as you know, too, that all of the negative aspects of diet we spoke about earlier, which also should include reduction of salt, are important and fundamental to lower blood pressure. Also, managing stress and anxiety is very important. Nutrition that feeds the autonomic nervous system, which is the nervous system that raises blood pressure, is essential. Omega-3s help to do that. Antioxidants help to do that. Magnesium, by the way, is also an antioxidant, but it's a mineral that's needed for nearly 500 different enzymatic reactions in the body. So when I look at an individual with any type of health issue, I first make sure that I'm familiar with the basic nutrition that's thought to help the condition. That's the things that you might hear, let's say, on a radio show like this. But then I figure out through testing and history taking and questionnaires and a conversation with whoever's working with me of what other specific nutrition they may need and lifestyle changes to help lower their blood pressure or whatever the health problems are. It's a fundamental way I approach people. Detailed questionnaires, detailed conversation, basic research on the basics, and then personalizing everything after that. Now, the number fifth most prescribed medication in the U.S. is metformin, which is generic for glucophage. Now, metformin is used to improve blood sugar control in people with type 2 diabetes, and it's commonly used in combination with other medications. It is not for type 1 diabetes. Now, metformin is generally used, as I mentioned, in persons with type 2 diabetes or persons with insulin resistance or metabolic syndrome. These are people, and a lot of you have this problem and you don't know it. You are insulin resistant. There is a blood test called hemoglobin A1C. If your hemoglobin A1C level, write this down, is a 5.7% or higher, you have insulin resistance and you may be on your way to diabetes. Now, physicians will put people on metformin for outright diabetes and for insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome, which, by the way, is a condition characterized by high blood pressure, high blood sugar, and high blood fats. And that's, of course, treated very carefully and specifically medically, but also nutritionally. But what is amazing to me is that a B vitamin that I mentioned earlier, it's called alpha lipoic acid, and I like to combine it with carnitine, makes it work better, is known to very effectively and dramatically lower blood sugar. So if you are diabetic and you're on medication, you don't go running out and get Lipitor and just start swallowing that stuff. You could cause a hypoglycemic reaction that can be very damaging. But lipoic acid does lower blood sugar. The amounts are much higher usually in my experience than what the bottle says is the minimum dose. Remember, when I create supplements, I place a minimum dose on the bottle because I put a dose there that makes sense. But an individual may need a lot more than that, or they may need less. But generally speaking, about 500 to 1,000, sometimes 1,500 milligrams of alpha-lipoic acid can straighten up someone's hemoglobin A1C. It focuses on reducing the insulin resistance, which will cause blood sugar to go up. You want blood sugar to be stable throughout most of the day. And the hemoglobin A1C test measures your average blood sugar over about 3 to 4 months. So it doesn't matter if you don't fast for that test that day. That doesn't matter. This is a non-fasting test. Again, it's an average of 3 to 4 months of your blood sugar. When you have your glucose level checked by your doctor, that's just the day's glucose, okay, which is important, particularly if it's high. Then, if it's high again, a doctor should be measuring hemoglobin A1C. But rather than just jumping to metformin, for example, or insulin, cleaning up the diet, whatever that means, based on some of what we said earlier, and also taking alpha-lipoic acid can be dramatic. And alpha-lipoic acid has also been specifically studied to help people with diabetic neuropathy. So neuropathy is pain from degeneration of the nerve and nerves in people with diabetes caused by high blood sugar. But lipoic acid is a liver antioxidant. It's great for liver health. It's a chelator. It binds to some heavy metals. It helps what I call real detoxification, meaning it actually works on known detox pathways in the body. Unlike some of the methods I described in my show, Detox Deception, lipoic acid is the real deal. Is it great for every toxin? Of course not. It's the detoxifier must be specific for the toxin. I hear people saying all the time, oh, Dr. Wald, I have heavy metals, this, that, and the other thing. I'm taking chlorophyll. Well, that's not going to work. That's just expensive fiber. You might as well eat a salad. It just won't work for real toxicity. Lipoic acid binds to metals. It increases glutathione in the body, which improves immunity. So my point here is that there are potentially substitutes and nutrients along with diet and lifestyle, including exercise, that can be used to reduce one's need and or side effects from metformin, the fifth most commonly used medication in the United States. So there are many other medications, obviously, for which we could discuss some of the key nutrients, basic vegan lifestyle, and exercise. But we are sadly out of time. So I do hope that you have a greater understanding of the complexities of medication use, medication abuse, and of course the importance of drug-nutrient interactions, both the positive ones, the good ones, and the negative ones. Our next show is entitled Everything Allergy: How Even the Process of Aging Itself is an Allergy, and what we can potentially do about it. How do we manage aging and disease? Well, if we think of our aging and disease in the context of we become allergic to ourselves, things get very interesting. So again, my name is Dr. Michael Wald. I am Director of Nutritional Services at Integrated Nutrition of Mount Kisco. For those of you who'd like to work with me, I would love to work with you too. My number is 914-242-8844. Please continue to send me your show ideas. I love them. Send them to my personal email, which is info@blooddetective.com. That's info@blooddetective.com. Or you can post your questions on my blog on my website. Here's the website address. It's www.integratednutritionny.com. Thank you so much again for the opportunity. I look forward to speaking with you soon about everything allergy. Come out, Virginia, don't let me wait. You Catholic girls start much too late.